Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Spech.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
Fantastic.
Just skippy-doodle, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Having a good time? Enjoying the hot weather?
It's been quite hot. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to get used to it. The first little bit of a heat wave a week and a half ago, something, it was, like, significantly hot. It was, like, what was at the time they said daytime high of 33 feels like 43 or something.
Something like that, yeah.
It's like, whoa.
I know. Tracy's got her car set to Fahrenheit, and it said 99.
Hmm. Why Fahrenheit?
I have no idea. Well, that's our one upstairs.
Thermostat?
Thermostat upstairs. No clue how to turn it to Celsius.
Oh.
No clue how to do that. So everything's in Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
But, yeah, everything else is Celsius. That's what I say. So, what's that in Canadian?
Yeah, what's that Canadian? I don't know.
We talked with Ian Parrish last week, and was just following his follow-ups after we'd left him.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes. Yeah, he's been wind, rain.
It's the high heat. It's the high heat brings in the wind,
off the
right?
Big lakes, right?
Yeah. So, it's unfortunate that, like, he's not only battling high temperature, threat of dehydration, he's now also, and water issues because of all the dead fish and the die-off, so it's hard for him to find fresh water. And with that, high winds. So he's having a time of it trying to get the kilometers in and move along.
Yeah, it's definitely does not make for an easy trip. You know, you're doing trips like these, you got to expect there's going to be delays and stuff like that. But when you're sitting there, it's a beautiful day out there.
Yeah.
But you just can't get on the water because the waves are so high.
It's beautiful and sunny, but I can't paddle.
Yeah. It's frustrating. And, you know, I was chit-chatting when there a couple of posts with him on social media and just said, try to stay out of your own head if you can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll get it done.
Yeah.
Enjoy it because the minute you're like, a month into being done, you're going to wish you were still back out there.
Yes, exactly. Right?
It's just like going on a trip. You know, you get home and then you get back to work and back into the routines. And you're just like, man, I wish I was still out there. Right? So, yeah, hopefully, you know, just get her done.
Yep,
keep
exactly.
on keeping on, as I said. But, yeah, just to watch his posts there with the bad weather.
There was
bad weather, but it's mostly wind.
It's high winds, and you can sense the frustration that he's dealing with. It's unfortunate, but you can't control the wind. You just have to deal with it and be safe and make smart choices, and I think he is making smart choices.
Yeah. Yep. That's all you got to do. So take your time, enjoy it as much as you can.
Yeah.
You get done when you get done.
Yeah. He's getting lots of beach time in.
Right?
There you go.
Yeah. I was just working on the tan. Yeah, not really the reason he went out there, but, you know. Other than that, yeah, we're just
plugging away.
Plugging away, man. Yeah. Doing the garden. We planted potatoes this year.
You did?
We did.
Wow.
Well, sorry, we did not. Tracy did.
The royal we.
Yeah, the royal we. Just like, we mowed the lawn. We cut that tree down. We planted potatoes.
Yeah. Nice.
And they're actually coming up.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we got tomato plants
right
now.
Beauty.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, I guess we're going to pick them. And
did you take potatoes from the kitchen or did you go get seed potatoes?
Nope. We had potatoes that weren't being used and we went to use them and they were looking at us because they had plenty
eyeballs.
Of eyes.
Yeah.
And then
you're going in the ground.
She's just put that outside and made a little. Well, I dug her a little garden spot there, and she put them in there. And yeah,
did you personally fertilize each potato plant?
I have no idea. I did not. Dog might have, but the dog we had found out does not understand a string fence.
Oh,
so we have stakes with string, like twine.
Yeah.
Couple rows of twine.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to keep her out. The squirrel goes ripping across the fence.
Yeah.
She goes right through it like she's just won a marathon. Yeah. Yeah.
Get some chicken wire.
Nah, nah. Because she'll just run into that. It's like our last dog went right through our screen door.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Didn't even... Oh, yeah, I forgot there was a screen there. Sorry about that.
Oopsie.
Just blows this door right out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. All righty. We've got a few things to talk about today.
We do.
We got a couple hundred things to talk about. Oh. What are we drinking tonight?
Yes, what it is.
Sleeve Monster Session Pale Ale from the Tilted Glass Brewing Company. It looks like a green cartoon werewolf on the front.
Yes.
Sleeve Monster Session Pale Ale. Not too bad.
Yeah. I do like it. Yeah, they were for sale last time we checked, weren't they?
Yeah, I don't know if they ever got sold.
Never heard.
Yeah. Yeah, as long as you still get
the beer. They haven't changed their name.
So, yeah, they must still be in business. Alrighty, let's talk some paddling and stuff. It's a little before 6 a.m. at the Baltimore waterfront. Picture, if you will. 6 a.m., Baltimore waterfront. Jesse Benson, owner of Be More Sup, stand-up paddleboard, is about to lead a group of half a dozen people on a paddle around the harbor. Sorry, watch the goose poop, she warns people as they move from the dock onto their boards. Feels like nature is meeting business here. Along with the goose poop and bird chirps, there are train whistles and cargo ships. Benson opened this paddleboarding location on the harbor just last summer. Business overall is more than a decade old. We'll just paddle that way toward the sunrise, Benson tells the paddleboarders, and then we'll do yoga right in this area.
Well, they're doing paddleboard yoga.
So they're doing paddleboard little doodly-doo around the harbor, and then they come back and do some yoga.
Have you ever seen them do yoga on a paddleboard?
Yeah. Yeah.
I can barely stand on one. I can't imagine doing yoga poses on a paddleboard.
I would die. I would roll over. That's my thing. Downward dog? No, it's downward drowning dog.
I'd hurt my back and right? then fall in.
Such a crick in my neck and I couldn't get back on my board. It may seem a little unusual to paddle for fun in Baltimore's harbor, which is known more for shipping and manufacturing than water sports. But Courtney Marshall, who is training to be an instructor at Be More Sup, wasn't fazed. I feel like I'm not going to fall in, so I'm a little bit less worried, says Marshall. Class costs $40. There are only a handful of people signed up for the day, and Benson said it's been slow going in these harbor locations, partly because people are worried about getting wet.
Why would you do SUP if you're worried about getting wet?
It's going to happen. They're nervous to try paddleboarding in the inner harbor. There's still that perception of, I don't want to fall in the harbor.
There is that. There's oils and there's, you know, pollution and there's who knows what else.
Right. There's an emerging trend among cities built on rivers to treat their waterways as economic assets for recreation, making them places where people are willing to spend money as they kayak, paddleboard, swim, and in some places even surf. This is an effort to both attract and keep residents and bring in tourism dollars. But for cities with histories of polluted waterways, that is to say a lot of them, it can require some convincing to make people jump in. Baltimore's harbor is still relatively early days for the water sports scene, according to Adam Lindquist, vice president of the Waterfront Partnership. It's one of the groups behind an initiative that started 15 years ago to clean up the harbor. There's been a marked improvement in Baltimore's water quality since then. So you're thinking 2010. They decide they're going to start trying to clean this up 15 years later.
Yeah.
They're still at it.
Still trying. Still trying, or are they finding success?
Oh, no, they're finding some success. We say the harbor is conditionally swimmable.
What does that mean?
Last year, Baltimore held its first organized public swim in the harbor in over 40 years. Tickets are sold out for another one being held later this summer. Endgame is that we want a public swimming spot in the Baltimore Harbor so that people can come down and swim on their own whenever they feel like it. For the time being, Lindquist said to avoid swimming in the harbor outside of organized events. There's still lots of commercial shipping here, and there are also some conditions that make a dunk unsafe. For example, when it rains, that can cause the city's sewer system to overflow.
Oh, yes. We had the same thing here in the GTA and stuff.
Oh, we've been talking about water lately. Yeah. It's tasting kind of funky. That carries bacteria into the harbor that can make people sick. And again, that's what's happening out in the lake right now, is with the big fish die off and the algae blooms and stuff, and you start getting a little notices saying, hey, this, like, Oshawa beach is closed, and this beach is closed, and that one's unsafe for swimming, and you can go to the beach, just don't go in the water.
Now, I don't think it was bacteria, but Ian Parrish was saying that the current fish die-off is a viral infection spread amongst the fish.
Yeah, I know he said something about it, but...
Yeah, I can't remember what he called it, but he couldn't remember the last letter of the three-letter thing. So I keep meaning to look it up, and I keep forgetting.
Yeah, but there's a lot of small fish,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a few inches long.
Yeah, all the...
All along the shoreline.
All the baby fish that are like...
Yeah. And gobies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I'd gone to meet them the one day, there's chit-chatting, and you look at the beach, and there's a bunch of dead gobies, which are an invasive species here. Right? So, they're even feeling the effects of it. We have a very industrial past in Baltimore City, like many cities, and basically you don't want to stir up the sediment at the bottom of the harbor.
Oof.
There are still challenges with pollution, including a recent diesel spill in the harbor. It was in a contained area, so it won't affect the upcoming harbor swim. But it doesn't help build the image of Baltimore as a swimming mecca. Overcoming the stigma is just as hard as overcoming the pollution. The move is treating urban rivers as recreation destinations is a shift. For decades, cities were more interested in protecting themselves from water as opposed to jumping in it. Which is, I mean, yeah, you got these beautiful skylines and everything in the city.
Beautiful waterway skylines.
And you're walking down, you know, along the waterway, and you're just like, I'm not getting into
that. Scum and dead fish.
Just like, ooh. But... We walled ourselves off from rivers and waterfronts out of fear, says Brian Trustee of PROS Consulting. His firm advises places, including Baltimore, on parks and recreation systems. He said over the last 20 years, the attitude has changed. Now he's getting calls from places around the country that want to turn their waterways into economic engines.
Yeah, instead of just dumping waste in them, let's clean them up and have people... recreate on them.
And it's becoming more, like they said, becoming more of a trend.
Mm-hmm.
Let's clean this up. It's been, I mean, it's like the Detroit River and stuff like that, till the point you're starting to see wildlife and stuff come back, right?
Yes, exactly.
Communities are seeing each other. They're seeing examples. They're like, oh, I want that, says Trustee. Yeah. One place Trustee's worked with it on this is Des Moines, Iowa, where Stephanie Opel leads nonprofit Iowa Confluence Water Trails, or ICON Water Trails. Iowa does not have the ocean. We do not have mountains, but we do have rivers, said Oppel. 2022, it found that recreation on water in Des Moines and the surrounding areas brought in more than $11 million in consumer spending. That's a lot of tourist bucks.
That's a lot, yeah.
Over half of that was from tourists. It's expecting to... about double that yearly spending by making some of its waterways not just boatable, but also surfable. We are putting in what's called a wave shaper. And we've talked about these things.
Yeah.
And they're pretty cool to be able to do that. Like some of them are putting them in under bridges and stuff like that.
Yeah, create a standing wave. And they can adjust. They're hydraulic and they can change the shape of the wave.
It is a big mechanical flipper that can create a surf wave. So late next summer, people will be surfing on the Des Moines River. It's not cheap. Opel says the wave shaper costs $1 million. These kind of projects also take a lot of time, and one challenge is keeping the momentum going. making sure that people understand this isn't going to be built tomorrow, but it will be built in a couple of tomorrows. So that is the big thing now is, and it's, I shouldn't say now, like over the last while and getting more and more popular is trying to keep people and spend their money in the cities. So, I mean, like here, okay, well, we're heading up to, like 2-3 hours north to go paddling and stuff like that.
And bringing
out
that,
of the city.
Bringing that economic impact to those remote areas. So let's keep the money here. Let's get people out recreating on the water and participating in outdoor sports and paddling and whatever. And if they can keep them here, it'll affect the remote locations, but people are still going to go there, but at least more people. And you're going to get people coming in from out of town. If somebody is in on business into Baltimore or whatever, for example, then they're going to be there. Say they're running a business. It's like, hey, let's go surfing Friday after our conference or yada, yada, yada. It's like, yeah, bring more money in and get more people interested into the local, how do you recreate here on the water?
Yeah, and you're here for a couple of weeks, so you got the weekend.
Yep.
Well, I'm going to go out in the water and see the skyline from the water. I'm going to do a bit of... Because, if you're a tourist or something like that, you don't necessarily know the places out of town.
Exactly.
So if you got the ability to do it on the local river or the local, harbor sort of thing, like they're saying in Baltimore... then that's just going to draw more people and make it 100%. More popular.
Yeah.
But like you say, you've got to make it so that you can do it safely.
Yes.
Because nothing like falling in and getting a mouthful of diesel fuel.
Yeah.
That's going to leave a taste in your mouth. hopefully Baltimore and... gets that cleaned up and they can really improve on that.
Yeah.
It'd be neat to see that wave shaper on the Des Moines.
I want to see one of those in action.
Right? I want to see you go over one accidentally.
Backwards in a canoe.
Backwards. Oh, I've done that. All right, let's get a little science-y.
Oh, science-y. I like it.
I think we got a little.
I was supposed to look this up. I never did.
Uh-oh. Instead of putting the pedal to the metal, team of scientists from Japan and Taiwan are putting the paddle to the water for science. Team used time period accurate tools to create canoes and use them to test the methods of ancient people would have used to travel across the sea in East Asia 30,000 years ago.
Zoinks.
See... That's why you need a time machine.
Yeah.
Just so that you can go back in time, see how they're doing it, come back here, see if they're doing it the right way. Otherwise, raise your hand and call BS.
You're wrong.
I saw them do it. Results of these test paddles and findings are detailed in two new studies published in June 25th of the journal Science Advances. When you think archaeology, a lot of people just think, we're digging up dead bodies
and
stuff like that. But putting it into practice, these things that you do find and, the technology that they use and actually putting it into practice on, this sort of confirms what we found on how they did this stuff. Archaeological evidence suggests that about 30,000 years ago, humans first made a crossing from present-day Taiwan to islands in southern Japan. This journey could have ranged from 138 to about 450 miles. That's a big gap. And was accomplished without metal tools, maps, or modern boats. While the timeline of when East Asia's earliest modern human population set sail and where they landed is fairly clear, how they did it has been more difficult to pin down. That's where these replica canoes come in. Team led by anthropologist Yusuke Keifu from the University of Tokyo created various simulations, experiments, and replica canoes to create how this feat may have been achieved. So it wasn't just like a one-off, this is how we're going to do it sort of thing. There was lots of simulations and experiments We initiated this project with simple questions. How did Paleolithic people arrive at such remote islands as Okinawa? How difficult was their journey? What tools and strategies did they use? Archaeological evidence such as remains and artifacts can't paint a full picture of the nature of the sea, is that it washes such things away. So we turn to the idea of experimental archaeology. It is similar vein to the Kon-Tiki expedition of 1947 by Norwegian explorer Thor Heyerdahl. So that's why he sort of did the same sort of thing. He said, well, this has got to be how they did it. And he did it. Built the boat and off he went. One of the new studies details the construction and testing of a real boat which the team successfully used to paddle between islands. Team constructed a 24-foot-long dugout canoe called Tsugame in 2019. It was built from one Japanese cedar trunk and with replicas of 30,000-year-old stone tools. So this wasn't just like a last year we're doing this sort of thing.
Yeah.
This has been ongoing from 2019.
I wonder what... I'm trying to Google stuff plus looking at the map here. So they talked about, I don't want to rewind too much, but they said that there was archaeological evidence that these people did this 30,000 years ago. Like, was there duplicates or similar technologies in carving tools? Or, like, they don't say
what
they
found. Well, they did find the tools, and they would have seen probably some sort of record of the boats, right?
And if you look at the map between Taiwan and Okinawa, whew.
Yeah. It's all open ocean.
It's a long stretch. Well, there's a whole bunch of little islands along the way.
Oh, yeah.
So they could island hop to get there, but still, it's a long way.
And you got the currents, you've got the weather.
Exactly, right?
Time of year you're going, because you get typhoons and stuff like that.
Yeah.
A dugout canoe was our last candidate among possible Paleolithic seagoing crafts for the region. We first hypothesized that Paleolithic people used rafts, but after a series of experiments, we learned that these rafts are too slow to cross the Kuroshio and are not durable enough, he says. So, yeah, there's lots of testing to do and experimentation.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Team paddled Tsugame about 140 miles from eastern Taiwan to Yonaguni Island in southern Japan's Ryukyu group, which includes Okinawa. So, yeah, there's all those little islands there, right? They navigated only by the sun, stars, swells, and their instincts. In total, the team paddled more than 45 hours across open sea without a lot of visibility of the island. In the last 6 years since, the team is still unpacking some of the data they collected during the experiment and are using it to inform or test new models about various aspects of Paleolithic sea crossings.
Hmm. Yonaguni is the closest island.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so being able, it's taken 6 years to, and they're still working off the data they collected.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Which is pretty
cool. That's amazing.
So, and then they're still doing more experiments to figure out stuff and, you know, on how they did it. Because that's what they want to know, is how did they get from there to there? And did they, you know, and that leads to the other questions of, did they go back and forth? When did trade start?
Like, there's a few one-off, again, I'm curious about the archaeological evidence. Is there evidence that they traveled multiple trips back and forth? Is this a routine thing? Was there trade between the islands?
Right.
Right.
We now know that these canoes are fast and durable enough to make the crossing, but that's only half the story, says Keifu. Those male and female pioneers must have all been experienced paddlers with effective strategies and a strong will to explore the unknown. However, the team does not think that a return journey towards Taiwan was possible at that time.
I mean, currents, right? Trade winds, maybe?
If you have a map and know the flow pattern of the Kuroshio, you can plan a return journey, but such things probably did not take place until much later in history. Right? Because you have to know.
Yeah.
the currents and stuff like that and the lay of the land.
So when they got to Okinawa, this is where we live now.
Right. The team also used advanced ocean models to simulate hundreds of virtual voyages in an effort to understand if a journey like the one the modern scientists tried could have been made in different circumstances. These simulations tested several variables, including different starting points, seasons, and paddling strategies under both ancient and modern ocean conditions. Additionally, one of the new papers used numerical simulations to show how they may have crossed the Kuroshio current, one of the strongest currents in the world. This simulation showed how boats made using tools of the time and the right know-how could have navigated the Kuroshio current. So it is possible they could have done it.
Yep.
And they could have gone back and forth. Kuroshio Current is generally considered dangerous to navigate. Yulin Chang, a study co-author and oceanography student.
And that's now.
And that's now, yeah. From the Japan Agency for Marine Earth Science and Technology. Holy jumpins. Says, I thought if you entered it, you can only drift aimlessly. But the results of our simulations went far beyond what I had imagined. I'm pleased this work helped illuminate how ocean voyages may have occurred 30,000 years ago. Because you got to be able to plug in. I mean, you have enough data that you can sort of, I would assume, guess how the currents would have been acting at the time and the changes and land masses and stuff like that. So you'd be able to plug those numbers in and get a fairly good idea on, if you go from here and start paddling out, the currents are going to take you to Ecuador.
Yeah.
Not like Taiwan.
30,000 years ago, though, like what kind of societies existed back then? Were they like feudal? Were these people that originally organized these long trips? Were they fishermen and they were stretching their legs further and further looking for different fish and discovered an island and then discovered another island and... So it's
interesting.
Could have just
been explorers like the Vikings, right?
Yeah, could have been.
Yeah, we're going to head that way.
And you have to wonder what initiates people to do something like that. Because this is a risk outside of their normal... It would be survival of the fittest 30,000 years ago, right?
Well, I got to think one of three things. Food, land, trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? You got to think it's one of those three things that they're hopping on these boats to do.
Yeah.
We need new food. We need new food sources. So let's go out and see if we can find some. We need more land.
Yeah, we need to capture more land.
Because, going inland from the coast is just big groups of people wanting to kill us.
Yeah.
And number three is like, okay, well, we got all this stuff here. Let's see if we can find somebody to trade it. And who knows what we can trade it for. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Right? So I got to think those are the three main things where they would have hopped on the boats to go or just out of pure exploration and, curiosity. Various simulations help fill in some of the gaps that a simple one-time experiment could not. They also reveal that launching a vessel from northern Taiwan offered seafarers a better chance of success than from points farther south. Additionally, paddling slightly southeast instead of directly towards the destination was essential to compensate for the powerful ocean current. And if you got no land to steer by, you don't know that you're drifting in another direction.
Oh, exactly.
If you think you're going east, and then realistically you're going north.
Current's taking you north,
Then you do have to, right? All in all, these findings suggest that early modern humans in the area must have had a high level of strategic seafaring knowledge.
Fishermen.
Mm-hmm. Scientists trying to reconstruct the processes of past human migrations, but it is often difficult to examine how challenging they really were. One important message from the whole project was that our Paleolithic ancestors were real challengers. Like us today, they had to undertake strategic challenges to advance. For example, the ancient Polynesian people had no maps, but they could travel almost the entire Pacific. There are a variety of signs on the ocean to know the right direction, such as visible land masses, heavenly bodies, swells, and winds. We learned parts of such techniques ourselves along the way. Hmm. How cool is that?
It's very cool. It's like, and trying to put the puzzle piece together about boat building and dugout canoes and stuff like that, ancient times, and then you think to yourself, it's 30,000 years ago. Like, it's so long.
Well, there's got to be records and stuff that they've accumulated over the years of archaeological
with just findings, right? Yeah. Fossil. Well, it wouldn't stuff be fossilized that, stuff, but it'd be like, you know, they'd be digging in old, they'd find an old camp and then they'd, you know, find stuff. But usually if you're throwing stuff out, you're throwing in the fire pit or whatever. So you usually find a lot of metals or leftover stuff in fire pits or nearby, or something gets lost in the village, or
they could have found something that only comes from. Like Okinawa.
These are techniques that were used in Okinawa. And where did these techniques come from? Oh, look, somebody in Taiwan used the same techniques.
Or even this rock.
This rock or this
type of statue.
This design of tool.
You know, whatever.
Only came
from there. Yeah. So, yeah. So they figured, you know, like I say, there's probably dozens of things that point the way to.
Yeah.
This is how we believe they did it. So let's try it out.
Huh.
And hope for the best.
Amazing.
Where do those five scientists go? Don't know. Then what they don't say here is you got to think they had a support boat with them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they don't mention any of that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they would have.
Six of us hopped in this big handmade
and
canoe.
Off
we went. Yeah, just so like they did 30,000 years ago.
Yeah, there were support boats. They had GPS.
Right.
Satellite comms, telephones, yada, yada, yada. They were able to call via satellite communications to, you know, yeah, we're doing
I think there was a big boat along with them just in case.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. 100%. Like a big yacht.
Yeah.
No, you guys are in the canoe for the next 45 hours. We'll be up here watching
you. If there's a typhoon, too bad. Right? Figure it out.
We'll be in here having a beer in the air-conditioned cabin watching you guys struggle. Yeah. Well, it looks like Phil been deposed.
Yeah. Oh, they lost one. Something got voted off the boat.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty cool, that sort of stuff. And this sort of archaeological seafaring and discoveries is happening more and more, and it's really cool
it's becoming
to see
more
that sort
rapid
of stuff.
There's more and more people looking into these things and pulling up details of certain things.
Yeah.
So I find it fascinating because we're learning in the last couple decades. You think about what we've discovered over the last century or two, and you think yourself, there's been a lot of extra discoveries that have been cropping up and popping up. It's
cool.
Just amazing how much technology is advancing. Like when you talk about LIDAR and so on technologies for, you know, scanning the you know, valleys and jungles, and they're finding all these new Incan ruins and stuff like that they've never knew existed, but now they're finding them because of the new technologies, and it's just fascinating when these things pop up in the news.
Yeah. It starts to point to where we've all come from, sort of thing.
And they're doing, what were they doing in, was it Michigan, all the boats that we're finding, they're using...
Oh, Wisconsin.
Yeah, Wisconsin. Yeah. So they're using technology in the winter, they're rolling across the ice to find targets.
Yeah.
So they're finding more and more stuff that way.
Village.
So, yeah, it's fascinating. Very much fascinating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. When you think of paddling with an animal, 9 out of 10 times you're thinking, actually I'd say 99 out of 100 times you're thinking
a goat,
a hippopotamus, oh, me and my llama going out. You're thinking a dog.
I think as a general rule, it's probably 99 out of 100, it's a dog.
Yep. We have been seeing a shift.
Yes.
Well, there's the people that took the snake to the beach.
Yes.
I think they're taking it to the beach. They're probably taking a paddle.
To Long Beach.
We've seen people with goats.
Yes, we've been seeing that lately.
And we've seen people with cats.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people, the cat will sit in the boat. And
The cats are all in. Like, the people who obviously are not going to publish if the cat hates the water, but the ones that we do see, I've seen a lot of people who have cats that love swimming, and they'll hop out of the canoe and
right.
It's just funny to see. It's like, look at that cat. It's just like, he's all in. He's like, woohoo.
So when a German shepherd in the midst of a kayaking adventure decided to leap off of a kayak and swim to shore, you don't quite expect his feline companion to dive right in after him.
Let's go.
But that's exactly what happened on this unforgettable kayaking adventure with Moose the dog and Peach the cat, proving just how deep the bond between these unlikely besties go. Judging from their TikTok videos, this is just was just yet another great adventure for the duo, who bonded almost instantly and have the been having nonstop fun ever since. And this just goes to the whole, there's more to animals than we think, right? Peach was introduced to Moose over 3 years ago when he was just a three-month-old kitten. The very first video documenting this duo, Moose can be seen completely covering the kitten with kisses while Peaches looks at him adoringly. Looks like definite love at first sight.
Who wrote this?
Not me. On this particular adventure, Moose and Peach are enjoying their kayak on a beautiful, absolutely beautiful sunny day. Suddenly, Moose decides he's done with water sports. If you watch the video, they're probably like a dozen feet offshore.
Mm-hmm.
So he's done with water sports, jumps right off. Peach doesn't even need time to think. Immediately the cat dives into the water following, while Moose looks back like, what's taking you so long?
I wonder if the cat initially says, oh, I'm following, and then an instant regret. It's like, what have I done?
Damn. viewers were just as surprised. One viewer named Sparkin says, the dog was like, yo, you seeing this? Jimmy Stark remarked, I've never actually seen a cat swim until now. Sarah proclaims Peach the coolest cat ever, for real.
For reals.
For reals. The bonded pets show us what true dedication, loyalty, and love look like. This fantastic moment is a reminder that true friendship knows no species. If you're on TikTok, check out Moose and Peach, their channel, all one word, Moose and Peach, on their TikTok, and you can see their videos and stuff. Now, I follow, and I've been following for years, Henry the Colorado Dog on Instagram. Henry the Dog and Baloo the Cat went everywhere together outdoors, hiking, camping, paddling, you name it. And they're like, even in the winter, they've got their own like jackets and stuff like that. And Baloo the cat, they're like, a lot of times he's like riding on top of Henry. Unfortunately, Henry passed away a couple of years ago. The owners brought home another rescue dog named Pancake. They call him Pan. Baloo has Pancake has now joined Baloo on all the outdoor adventures. So it seems dogs are not the only ones heading out on adventures into the great outdoors anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Which, like I said, I mean, growing up, it was always, let's go out with our dog and we'll run in the woods, exactly, and we'll do this, yeah, and that and the other thing. But now the new thing seems to be whatever animal you've got.
Yeah, boa constrictor.
Now, yeah. I haven't seen gerbils, guinea pigs, hamsters, or anything small like that. Because you got to think, if you're out there in the kayak and your guinea pig is sitting out in the front and enjoying the sun, and I don't know, say maybe a big old bald eagle happens, oh, exactly, to pass by. Yeah. Or a rabbit, your pet rabbit.
Yep.
Right?
Dinner.
You don't really want to take that chance. So how did your bunny enjoy kayaking? Great, right up until he became dinner for the eagle.
Didn't work out so well.
But you got to think, you got to really keep an eye on the cat, too.
Oh, yeah. They're small enough. Right? They can They're be small
enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it seems to be a lot of people having, like, cats and dogs together.
Yes. That's the most common.
But to have a cat jump off the boat and just start swimming.
I know.
Huh. Like, I can't even get my cat into a bath. Like, yeah, without a
panic mode,
total suit of armor on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, pretty cool. Yeah, Moose and Peach TikTok channel. And go to, they still call it Henry the Colorado Dog. Go check him out on Instagram and see what the sort of things they get up to. But that's pretty cool to be hiking through the mountains. You got this dog with you and this cat, and they're all just trouncing along. And then you turn around, and the cat's jumped up on top of the dog to catch a ride.
Yeah.
And all that sort of thing. So that's pretty cool. I got another thing here. This I found this article. There comes a point in your life when, you know, guys like Derek think you're too old, where you start to think about the past and the present. What you've done with your life, what you wish you've done, do you have any regrets, that sort of stuff. And most importantly, what you still want to do with your remaining years, however many you may have.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know. I mean, you could be mid-50s and pop off at any second. Or you may be mid-50s and still got 40 years to go. You don't know.
Exactly.
Right? And this sort of came hit along the right time because we're having discussions at work and stuff like that about people that they don't do anything.
Hmm.
They work. They go home. Get dinner. Sit in front of the boob tube.
Yep.
Go to bed. Get up. Come to work. Go home. Have dinner. Watch the boob tube. Go to bed. Get up. Go to work. See a plan there? It's the same thing. So what did you do this weekend? Nothing. Just sat at home, watched some TV.
Caught up on some Netflix.
Yeah, caught up on some Netflix. And so that we had this conversation about that sort of thing. It's like, you know, what are you doing? Well, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, I'm doing this. Got to go do this. I'm hoping to get out for a paddle. Hoping to do this. Got to go do this. Oh, my God. Do you, like, not sleep? As long as I get my 5 hours a night. And I came across this article by Dennis Anderson of the Minnesota Star Tribune. Although a tad depressing at times, I can think of worse things. This would be Bob James' final paddling trip.
Okay.
The last among many, though he had no way of knowing that when he picked up a solo canoe from an Ely outfitter on May 8th.
This is Boundary Waters area.
Yep. And when you go through the article and you read it, you start thinking, just because you don't know, like, after having a life that you've, I mean, you do your work and your family, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But enjoying your time in the woods, in canoeing, in camping, being outside, all that sort of stuff. Your very last act is outdoors.
Yep.
On a solo canoe trip. James first paddled the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness as a kid, along with his dad, his brothers, and two sisters. He owned a paddleboard and a kayak, but no canoe. So the 16.5-foot scimitar-like Winona Prism, he slid into the pristine waters of Boundary Waters 2 days before the fishing opener was a rental. 48 hours later, James' body was found floating in Iron Lake by the U.S. Forest Service crew on a routine patrol. Iron Lake is about 50 miles from where James started his trip. James was wearing his life jacket. His canoe was capsized nearby. He was 62. Easier ways exist to get to Iron Lake than from the Stewart River off Echo Trail at about 22 miles from Ely. But Stewart River was like the wilderness access permit James held. And to him, the portages that separated it from Iron Lake likely weren't so much as obstacles as they were inconveniences. Bob was always in great shape, his sister Nancy Oliver says. I remember on our Boundary Waters trip, he would carry a full load of gear across the portage, then he'd come running back past us going for another load. James preferred to paddle in the Boundary Waters in early May before people and bugs, Derek, show up to in droves as they typically do later in the month. James also knew early May provides some of the border region's best fishing. He knew, too, that on the first day of the state's fishing season, hungry walleye would tumble and churn in the foamy waters below Curtin Falls, which spill into Iron Lake from the adjacent Crooked Lake. Curtin Falls was one of his favorite places in the Boundary Waters, Oliver says. Software engineer James was a sociable guy who will be remembered by his friends, according to his obituary, for his unmatched goofiness, his unapologetic lack of filter. Comfortable in any group, he also had no problem being alone. I canoed many times with Bob in the Boundary Waters, says friend Bruce Asmus. As high schoolers, the two ran cross-country together in Hopkins, Minnesota, and then continued to meet weekly at Theodore Worth Regional Park as members of the Thirsty Thursday Theo Trail Runners Club. Holy jumpins. At times during our canoe trips, we'd be in huge storms, but Bob was always prepared. He knew what to do. For him, traveling alone in the Boundary Waters was no big deal. He did it many times. High temperatures in the Boundary Waters on May 8th were forecast to touch 70 with bluish skies. Similar weather was expected on the fishing opener and beyond. Far less pleasant conditions occasionally prevailed when James' dad, Bob Sr., hauled Bob and his three younger siblings into the Boundary Waters when they were kids. Reminds me of the Calvin and Hobbes.
Oh.
Every time they go camping, it's always bad weather. If it doesn't kill you, it builds character.
Yeah, yeah.
We lived in Minnesota 25 years, the elder James said. Every summer when the kids were teenagers and even before that, I'd take them to the Boundary Waters. It was a magic time, but sometimes I look back at it and say, why did I do that? Mosquitoes could be terrible, and especially at the beginning, we'd take too much stuff. The kids would call it the March from Hell, but we went back 7 or 8 years straight. But that's what the memories and everything are made of.
Absolutely.
Right?
And the portages might be a pain in the butt, and the bugs might be bad, but generally, that's just part of the deal. Yeah. That's just part of it.
Yeah, when you go through the different types of fun you're having at the time.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my God, these bugs are just ridiculous.
But it sets good memories.
Right? Well, I wouldn't say they're good memories, but they're memorable memories.
Yes, yes.
Remember that time we were on that trip and like the bugs were so bad? You know, yeah, you're just going through all these things and these are the way you do it. This is, you've always been doing it this way and you just keep doing it. And yeah, I mean, like he says, do you take too much stuff? And over the years, you start to pare things down and streamline your gear and that sort of stuff. Among his siblings, Max, Nancy, and Betsy, James retained the most active outdoor lifestyle. Whether at home in the Twin Cities or up north, he'd rise at 5 a.m. to fish.
Wow.
He loved to hike, and in winter, he snowboarded.
Wow.
See, and this is the sort of thing that I was talking about there when I was talking to the group at work there. And like, a lot of people I know, when winter hits, if you're not into skiing,
yeah,
then you're into nothing.
You're done for the winter.
You're done for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Once it gets too cold, people pack up and they sit in the house.
Yeah,
it's like there's more to do. I mean, when we go, we do the winter camping and stuff.
Yeah, we do too.
And people look at you like you're a loony.
You do what? I know. Yeah. People at work look at me all the time like, you camp in the winter? Like, it's like, yeah, the highlight is no bugs.
That's the big thing.
But for the most part, it's like, it's a lot of, I do a lot of snowshoeing. Used to do a lot more cross-country skiing, but I have like 4 sets of snowshoes for different uses, and everybody else, like, I think Stella has 2 pair, Beckett has 1 pair, Siobhan has 1 pair, she uses mine usually. But yeah, we do snowshoeing. Mm-hmm.
I used to cross country ski out in Saskatchewan
because
you could for days and still be waving at mom.
Keep walking until you hit a mountain, right? Then come back.
Yeah, so this is the thing. Like I say, when he's loving a hike, he's wintery snowboarding, that sort of stuff. He's constantly going. Counterintuitively, perhaps, he pursued these activities even though he had a heart arrhythmia for which he was being treated. And again, the whole thing of, I'm not going to let something stop me from doing the things I love if there's ways around it. As a precaution, doctors implanted a defibrillator in his chest about a dozen years ago. When we ran together, I'd pay close attention to how he was doing, probably a little closer than he wanted, Asma says. If he'd slow down or stop, I'd say, is something going on? How do you feel? But usually it wasn't a problem, and we'd just start running again. En route to Iron Lake, James might have carried all his gear in two Duluth packs, slinging one over his pack and toting the other one on his chest, strapped on like an accordion. I have done that.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of you doing that.
That way, with the ultralight canoe on his shoulders, he could cross a portage in one trip.
So much
we
extra.
Did that big one into Hogan, doing it that way.
Yep.
And he's like, yeah. You sometimes you do things like that, and yeah, you definitely regret it at the time.
I recall that portage into Hogan as being one of the worst portages I've ever done. Just because, so we started off, and not knowing the elevation gain of the portage, I didn't hold any gas back. I was given it, and then at the end of the portage, it was like, what is it, 500, 600, 700 meters of just uphill?
Yeah. And well, that was the portage that the Bear and I had the meet and greet.
Yeah.
Into Hogan, yeah.
It was a lot of work.
Yeah. Ah, you're still alive.
Now that I know, I would pace myself early on so that I had some gas left for that hill.
Right? You've done the one from Cedar into Catfish? Unicorn Hill?
Yeah. No, I've never done that one.
Have you?
I've never done
You've
Unicorn.
You've never done Unicorn Hill?
No.
Oh, dude. Go do Unicorn Hill.
No, I've heard too many stories about it. I'm not interested.
Oh, you think Hogan's bad? Picture the horn on a unicorn.
Yeah.
That's like straight up. I think if in the winter, that's how our parents went to school.
Yeah.
It was that whole hill both ways.
They need to build a tunnel.
Oh, yeah. This way, with the ultralight canoe on his shoulders, he could cross a portage in one trip. I've gotten over that. I don't care. I'll double trip every day if I can. When we traveled to the Boundary Waters, Bob was always the leader. And when he took friends or relatives on paddling trips, he planned everything, including meals. He always built fresh fish into our meal plans. If it were me alone, I would never plan on catching fish to eat on a canoe trip. I'd bring plenty of other food, but Bob was a great fisherman. He planned on catching fish to eat, and he always did.
Nice.
Yeah, I do that too. I'll bring food. I'm bringing this food back with me because I'm going to catch fish.
Yeah.
Some days I don't bring that food back with
me. Yes, because the fish are not being caught.
The fish were not participating. Iron Lake's 2,000 pine-shrouded acres are as picturesque as any in Minnesota's border country, and its waters are pure. But for many paddlers, after the fishing opener, Iron is more of a pass-through lake than a destination. Yet whether James planned to stay on Iron Lake until his scheduled exit from the wilderness May 15th, or instead travel to another boundary lake, will never be known. An autopsy revealed no indication of health issues, or for that matter, trauma, and James' death was ruled an accident. The late author and wilderness guru Sigurd Olson once wrote that when a man is part of his canoe, he is part of all that canoes have ever known. By that measure, Bob James traveled widely and knew a lot, including the satisfaction of physical exertion in a watery wilderness, the thrill of a fish on his line, the seduction of a loon's call, and the promise of a morning campfire with coffee brewing. I don't want anyone to think Bob made a mistake going to the Boundary Waters alone. His death is not a cautionary tale, and it shouldn't be viewed that way. He knew what he was doing, his sister says. It's just that something happened, and we'll never know what it was.
Hmm. There you go.
Doing what he loved to do right up until the end. You'll never know what happened. But you know, like I say, I found this article after having these discussions at work, and I'm thinking, would you rather this or sitting in a chair?
Died with a TV dinner on your lap,
right?
Watching TV.
Which one would you rather have,
mm-hmm.
honestly? I mean, I'd rather have neither, but...
I've seen a few memes lately. It was, don't tell people I died doing what I love. Just know that my last words were, oh, crap, I screwed that up.
I saw one, I have two wishes when I die. Number one, spread me at the beach. Number two, I don't want to be cremated.
I've heard that one. I do not want to be cremated.
Yeah. Spread my body at the beach. I don't want to be cremated. But you know what? Like, that's it. It's like, don't wait.
Yes.
Get out there and do
exactly.
what you want.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot of naysayers saying you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
And if we live by those rules, you'll never do anything.
Yeah.
You're going to be there with the... Unfortunately for Bob James,
yeah.
You know, like they say, they'll never know what happened. It was an accident. Something happened. That's why we call them accidents.
Mm-hmm.
Could happen to any one of us.
Yeah.
But he was enjoying doing what he was doing and out in the wilderness with his canoe.
Yeah.
And that's all we'll ever know.
Good for him.
Good for him.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I've got this week.
I've got a background to a term you used.
Background to a term I used?
Yes. You said it like four times. Boob tube.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, what's that from? Well, the term boob tube is slang for a television set originating in the U.S. around 1959.
I'm an old-timey guy.
It likely refers to the rounded shape of the older television sets, reminiscent of a tube or a cylinder, combined with the word boob, which at the time was slang term for a stupid person. The term is considered a pejorative, implying that television programming is foolish and that those who watch it are unintelligent.
Yeah.
There you go.
Look at those boobs.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you know there's a bird called the blue-footed booby?
I want to see one of those things. The color blue of their feet is amazing.
Right?
Amazing.
Yeah.
I just looked up a blue-footed booby last week.
It was an accident, wasn't it?
No, it was a Google. I searched it.
You weren't looking for blue feet. How do blue feet get in front of that? You got anything else
I do to not.
This week? All right. Well, if you want to find out more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream all our episodes at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time. We'll